The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's book club comes to you from the Edinburgh International Book Festival, where we discussed Margaret Atwood's Booker-winning novel, The Blind Assassin. Published at the very start of the new millennium, the year 2000, it's a complex novel set in the 1930s and 40s and made up of interlocking narratives in different genres. Atwood has written that she started out with a story and then had to work out the form in which to write it, as she told our book club host, John Mullen.
So I started with the central character being dead and the younger relative finding the proverbial hat box with the proverbial cache of letters that revealed that this already dead person had a secret life that we didn't know about until then. I threw that out. Then I started again, and I had two journalists investigating this elderly person still alive who had a dead, well-known sister. And so they were on to something about that. And this time the hat box had become bigger and it had become a suitcase. And inside the suitcase there was a photo album. Unfortunately, the two journalists, one male, one female, and he was already married with twins, started having an affair. And that took over the book, and they had to be suppressed, put in a drawer, and firmly closed up within the drawer. The photograph album and the suitcase were tossed out, but one photograph remained. Somewhat altered.
Yes.
Then I had to start again, go back to the beginning, and this time I let the elderly person speak for herself. And the suitcase became even larger, and it became a steamer trunk. And inside the steamer trunk are all kinds of things of deep interest. And you know that I'm telling you the truth because there's a chapter called The Steamer Trunk in the book to this very day.
And what about the, as it were, the story that you wanted to tell? Because partly, I mean, there are these central characters that we'll come to in a second, but it's also what is sometimes slightly rudely or pejoratively called a saga, isn't it? It's a kind of family saga. You go across whole century. You do the main narrator's grandparents and parents. And I mean, was the inclination that you wanted to tell a story of generations? Was that very fundamental to it?
I started thinking that I was going to tell about my grandmother's and mother's generations, which covered pretty much the whole century. But they were too nice to be in a novel by me, so I couldn't write about them. My grandmother's knitting during World War I does get in. As it turns out, she was a terrible knitter. And in that knitting group, you were allowed to start with washcloths. And then if you got better, you could go on to scarves. And if you got better than that, you could do balaclavas. And if you got even better, you could do socks. And she never made it past the washcloth.
Yeah, I mean, the extraordinary bit and the very necessary bit for the novel is, I suppose, the kind of political aspect of that history, which requires Alex actually to be sort of on the run. I mean, so
yeah,
you have this...
Yeah, as people were.
Yeah.
So the political background of those years is that Canada went into World War I about the same time that Britain did. Unlike the United States, which went in quite a lot later, right at the end. And that's why in every small town in Canada, you're going to find these war memorials, which were a great subject of debate in those towns. What sort of memorial should it be? And that debate features in the book because Iris's father is involved in it, having been in the war, having lost his brothers, and having come back in really quite an altered condition.
Yeah.
But so what? How are you going to memorialize this? And there actually is a book written about it, which was very useful to me. So some people thought they would put up statues, and there are quite a few statues, as in Britain. And some people thought they would put up things like memorial skating rinks. And so you have quite different forms of memorialization and quite a lot of language, which is in fact religious in nature. You've heard it yourself. They made the ultimate sacrifice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that features in the book as it did in Canada. Canada went into World War II in 39, whereas, as you know, the United States didn't go in until Pearl Harbor, so end of 41. And therefore, everybody in Canada at that time would have had somebody in one or the other of those wars, or possibly both of them. So the 30s was the interim period, and the Spanish Civil War, of course, got going then, and it was illegal to go off and join it on the one hand, but on the other hand, the conservative powers that be in Canada wanted those people to go off and join it to get them out of the country and maybe they would get killed. Later known as premature anti-fascists. In other words, they're anti-fascists, but too early. All of the news events that I put in the book are about real occasions, except the ones I made up. But the public ones, like the big meeting of the Communist Party in Toronto, those are all real.
And what you eventually did is really complicated and far harder, must have been, to sustain than the two alternatives you...
There was always going to be that other story.
Right, the blind
that
assassin
was there
story.
There from the beginning. And there was always going to be another narrative line, which is the news stories, which contradict in some instances what we're being told by the central character. At the very beginning of the novel, we realize that the story that Iris is telling is different from what immediately appears in the newspaper. And what happens at the beginning of the book is that Iris's sister, Laura, drives a car off a bridge. And one side has it that it was an accident. Iris knows it was deliberate. And for all of these kinds of events, of course, I have to walk around Toronto and find out the exact place on the bridge where the car would have gone over, where it would have landed, and whether what I describe could have happened.
Right.
I'm sure that Ian Rankin does exactly same thing.
Yes.
Walks around Edinburgh and figures out which car park he's going to stuff his body in.
But what about...
Sort of like being the Easter Bunny.
So can we, I mean, the newspaper, I want to ask a sort of dry as dust, literary critical question about the use of the newspaper. So you do something quite specific with them in the early part of the novel, and something entirely calculated, which is that you tell us some things which are going to happen a lot later. You tell us about Amy's sad death long before she's ever born.
Yes, but our narrator begins at quite an elderly age.
Yes. So
she already knows these things.
Yes.
And it is she who is, in fact, composing the story. So it's no surprise to her.
No.
She does, however, have a... Because I think when people write things down, they always have a reader in mind.
And when the narrator says things like, you will already know this, to her imagined reader...
You say,
reader,
no, I don't.
Oh, no. What, you mean this book wasn't written by Laura, it was written by Iris? I think that was a big surprise to me.
Only if you weren't paying attention to... To the clothing.
So the clothing.
Yes, the clothing.
That's the clothes.
The clothing.
Yeah.
It's a
there
good
are people
example.
Here who got the clothing. I can see
yes,
them.
Yes, there are people who
so
got
what,
the clothing.
So tell me about the clothing.
Well, all right.
Okay.
Laura is quite a sloppy dresser.
Yes.
Iris
is yes, of
not.
Course, yes. And the woman is always, yes.
She's always very well done up.
Yes, that's so true, yes. The title, okay. The title, The Blind Assassin. There's a story that within that, Alex, who invents sort of sci-fi fantasies, a story he, although he's not named, tells to his lover, a sort of kind of post-coitally sort of thing.
Yes, some pre, some post.
Yes. He tells various stories, but the main story he tells is this kind of elaborate, bit by bit, as if he's inventing it as he goes along, of the blind assassin who is blinded by having worked on carpets, and he has to kill the maiden who's had her tongue cut out, and da-da-da-da-da.
Yes, it's very 1001 Nights.
Yes. Yes. So it's that, right, so it's a mixture of sort of sci-fi and Arabian Nights. And
actually, it's sort of Weird Tales about 1934.
Right. Okay.
And that kind of
they did things
crossover,
like, right,
a lot.
The Blind Assassin is, of course, the title of the novel that Iris has written, but it's also this fable. The Blind Assassin,
yes,
is this fable. And by giving your novel that title, it, I think, makes most readers think, so what's the fable? Who is the Blind Assassin?
I just saw The Hobbit, the
yes,
film.
The film, what?
Yes. There is a riddle contest between the effectively played Gollum and the really fairly convincing, you have to admit, Bilbo Baggins.
Yes.
Okay, so one of the riddles is time.
Yes, yes.
Which devours everything.
Yes.
And some of the people proposing who is the blind assassin answers, somebody said time.
Ah, okay.
Which is also pretty good.
Yeah.
So some people said it was Iris.
Well, she does sort of kill Laura. She's
Without meaning
no,
to.
No, without, so obviously, but...
Partly that. So there's that possibility. There's the more obvious Richard. I did have somebody in Canada saying, I just finished The Blind Assassin, it's about my relatives. And I said, surely not Richard. He said, I could take you down to the club and introduce you to four Richards. And
four I said, Richards?
Yes. And then I said, surely not Winifred. He said, Winifred is my aunt. So...
all the characters except Iris, all of them are a bit mysterious, actually, because...
because she's telling about
it. Yeah, because
them.
She's telling it, and even Iris goes, Richard, now he's a bit of a... he's a cardboard cutout to me somehow. I can't see his face, I can't... and she writes at some length about how difficult it is for her to sort of see him, because he is a real monster, isn't he? And yet, what he gets up to is always something we only know from sort of the bruises that are there afterwards. He's a very, very bad person.
I mean, he wouldn't say so.
No.
People don't usually say, I'm a very, very bad person. They usually say, I'm justified in all of my actions and you don't understand. He's bad from the point of view of Iris, but he's not bad from the point of view of Winifred. She has a married name and she's kind of put her husband in a cupboard somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, we don't actually know what's happened to him, but the most important relationship in her life is her relationship with Richard, whom she enables. So she is one of those complex society ladies who is enabling the social position of her closest family, who is her brother. I did know somebody who had a husband sort of concealed somewhere. You never saw him. It wasn't that she'd killed him.
No.
She just sort of marginalized him so much that he was invisible in her presentable public life.
It's time that I gave everybody here a chance. We've got a couple, we've got two or three traveling microphones.
Hiya, it was really just a point that Laura could have written the book because she could have been Alex's lover as well.
She certainly...
So I think it's not only the clothes give away that Iris is the lover.
She certainly wanted to be. From the point of view of the reader of the book, there's enough space and time where she could have been, but she wasn't.
Please.
It's a pleasure hearing you speak. You're my favorite novelist. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about, you have a recurring theme of the color mauve in almost all of your novels. Several things are listed as being mauve. I was just wondering what the color signifies to you.
Yeah.
Now, I've never been asked that question before. I have been asked, why are there so many eggs in your books? I've been asked, why are there so many bathtubs in your books? And I've also been asked, why are there so many glass jars in your books? What about mauve? I think it was one of those colors when you were growing up and looking at the names of colors. It probably just stuck in my head. It must be a motif. It's a motif. Yeah. I offer this motif to future dissertation writers.
Yeah. Yeah. Sir, please.
The first question is about, again, John's comment on this 1001 Nights Meet sci-fi. So where did this, a story about another galaxy, another planet, and this, this come into your scheme of characters? And my second question is, what advice would you give to someone who's got tales to tell and stories to tell and who is not necessarily a writer or a horrible writer at all?
That's two very different questions. One of them is, where did the motifs for the sci-fi pulp?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm an omnivorous reader, and I will, in fact, read anything. And grew up in the 40s and 50s, which was still the age of pulp science fiction magazines, which frequently took motifs from much older literature, including the 1001 Nights and One Night, which is a real source of a lot of later stories. Gets into the Decameron folk tales of Europe. A lot of those stories have circulated the globe in one form or another. Some of it from Herodotus, you know, how you get into a city that seems to be very well defended. The city that is that has become a heap of rubble and is known by the name of the heap of rubble is actually from the Bible. It's the city of Ai, A-I. The folding up of the city into a very small form you will be familiar with from the 1001 Nights and One Night, because genies can do that and transport cities here and there and shrink people and keep them in a bottle and other things like that, or an egg. I've been reading folk tales and that kind of things since for a very long time. I went to the library as soon as I had one available to me and got out all of the Andrew Lang collections. Remember them? The green fairy tale book, the pink fairy tale book, the yellow fairy tale book, the blue fairy tale book, the brown fairy tale. He ran out of colors after a while. I don't think there's a mauve fairy tale book. There might be. I think there is. So it's just a huge load of lore out of which people have been putting together other stories for a very, very long time. And my guy is a tale spinner. He's making a living by writing pulp fiction, which people did in the 30s if they could write very quickly and under a number of different names. So you had to use a number of different names so people wouldn't get tired of you. What to do if you have tales to tell but think you're not a writer? Anybody who can write things down on a piece of paper is a writer. It then is up to you to become a better writer, and you do that by writing and reading, practicing and editing what you have written. And I would just say, plunge in. If you have a story to tell, tell your story and then see how well you've done it. That's how everybody starts. That's how everybody keeps on. And if you do, say, 200 words a day, good or bad, rain or shine, just do it. You'll soon find that you're becoming much more proficient.
With such a complicated book as The Blind Assassin, do you write through an entire sequence of the story first, or how does that fit in?
Okay, it works like this. I wrote it in sequence, but as an aide memoir, I wrote the months of the year down the left-hand side of the page, and I wrote the years across the top. And then I decided when the birthdays of the characters were, so I would always know in any given year how old they were and how old they were in relation to each other. And then I could write in world events, like when exactly was the beginning of World War II, how old therefore were the characters then, when did the Depression begin? How old were the characters then? How long did it take it to kick in? When was the bottom part? When was the worst? And old newspapers are a great help for that. You can usually find them on microfiche in public libraries. Thank you, public libraries. Thank you for saving a bunch of junk that you thought nobody would be interested in. And the other thing that's a great help are the advertisements in old magazines. They don't tell you what people wore, but they tell you what people thought they should have been wearing, the look of an age. Yeah. So I could pretty much time and place the advent of any given clothing item, hat, or appliance.
My daughter brought up this question, asked me to ask it, and I think it's quite relevant. Why, when Laura's colouring in the library, is it always one colour?
She picks a colour that for different people that she thinks is appropriate to them. So she doesn't just colour with one colour. She colours different people different colours, whether she likes them or not, or whether she thinks they're obtuse. So I think how people colour things, you know, what how they colour their pictures, especially children, it's very telling.
Clearly it's a very dark story, and I'm interested in the moments of humour in it. There are some real laugh-aloud moments. The one which springs to my mind are the flammable red shorts of the aliens.
I'm very interested, and I actually have quite a large military library for several different reasons, and I'm very interested in clothing technologies and the effects that they have had on armies. A neglected field of study, but for instance, Napoleon took no winter clothing when he invaded Russia. Bad mistake. Very bad mistake. The pants in the Korean War were made of nylon. But nylon, when you walk, goes psh, 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 psh. It made people very audible. Bad clothing to have for a war that was fought a lot in the dark by guerrillas. People should never, in World War II, have lit their cigarettes by striking the match on their zippers. Very visible. Snipers.
One of the most fascinating characters I found was Winifred. I mean, she's a total monster, but a very, very convincing one. And I wondered, you know, whether there was a person or perhaps several people you knew who were actually like that you drew on in painting this picture.
I don't think it's an unusual type in certain social circles, and the higher you get, the more you encounter it. So if you're reading up on the Tudors, as we all do,
yes.
There would have been a number of women like that. It's the people with the most to lose socially who generally are the most like that. So the more your life involves facade, acting, and costume, and maintaining a status, the more you're going to be wishing to control the other members of your family and wishing to control their public presentation. So in a way, people of the level of Iris and Laura are less free in societies like that than people of a much lower social status who don't have things to lose and can jolly well do what they like. And I think that has in a way always been true. So there was always more skullduggery doings and rolling about in the hay in the servants' quarters than there were among the carefully controlled daughters who had to be married off in an intact, if possible, way.
You're clearly a very well-read and very, very well-educated lady. But
I'm just old. It accumulates.
Have you managed to train your brain that when you're in the depths of a book, you focus just on that book, or are you constantly scribbling down plot lines and plot ideas for the next book and the one after that?
I'm pretty much concentrating on that one when I'm writing it, because there isn't a lot of room for thinking about anything else. So yes, pretty much one at a time, although I usually have a couple in the wings, not yet illuminated, but lurking.
I'm very interested, this kind of spin-off question, very interested in the story within the story and how it relates to your enchantment with weird tales and pulp fiction of that kind. And I'm wondering if, you know, can you identify a moment when you went off science fiction, when it sort of lost its sense of enchantment?
I actually never ceased to be interested in certain kinds of it. I was never too keen on the techno phase. I was always more interested in the kinds of stories that were more like fables, or that drew more on the wonder tale inheritance, which is where those things came from. So the deep Victorian background, of course, which is drawing on a yet deeper folktale background, was always of more interest to me, but there are two strands even of that, and there's the Jules Verne strand, submarines could really happen in the future, and there's the H.G. Wells strand, it's unlikely we'll be doing time travel anytime soon. And one of them diverged and became Star Trek, or possibly even more so Star Wars. And the other one diverged and became 1984. So the kind that I myself am able to write is more like the 1984 kind. The story within the story gave me a chance to play in the world of the Wonder Tale, which, however, I'm not really capable of writing a full-blown example of.
Seeing that the novel itself spans so many different generic conventions of fantasy, of the family saga, of a historical novel, how relevant do you think these taxonomies are in writing the novel or appreciating it? Or are these just artificial descriptors assigned by publishers later on?
Well, the whole idea of genre is pretty recent. So Robert Louis Stevenson did not think he was writing horror when he was writing Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He thought he was writing an intriguing tale. He probably would have called it a tale. The 19th century did make a distinction between the romance and the novel. So they were thinking in those terms already. Hawthorne says the Marble Faun is a romance, not a novel. So I'm more interested in whether a book is good than what, quotes, genre it is. You could say that Owen Wister's The Virginian is the first Western. That's not very helpful. You can trace a lot of the conventions of the Western back to it, but he himself did not think he was writing a Western. He thought he was writing a novel set in a place where people had not set novels before, and that was interesting to him. Frankenstein. She did not think she was writing science fiction. She thought she was writing a complex fable having to do with God and possibly Paradise Lost and Prometheus. She became an ancestor of a certain kind of science fiction, but that's different. Sort of primitive man did not say, oh goody, I'm the ancestor of John Mullen. So I'd say help yourself. You know, I don't think there are these rules. I don't think there are fortresses that only certain people get let into. You know, sometimes literary, quotes, literary writers get screamed at because they've crossed a boundary. They've gotten out of their box. Yeah. They've invaded somebody else's, what somebody else thinks of as their territory. Well, guess what? Nobody owns those territories. Just, it's each one to himself or herself when it comes to that blank page. You get to put on it whatever you fancy.
We have to end, sadly, and I apologize to those of you who had questions and didn't get the chance. And thank you all very much for coming and for your questions. And I'm sure you're gonna sign some books if they...
Oh,
yes.
Oh, beg and please.
Yes, yes. So I will whisk Margaret away and she'll sign books if you want, and I'm sure you'd like me to thank her on your behalf.
The Books Podcast from Guardian.co.uk.